Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al. There's
always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
All right, episode 5, season 1 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by Redcon 1, Old School Labs, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Six Pack Bags. All right, welcome everybody to episode number 5, season 1 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we are talking about the 40th anniversary of the movie Pumping Iron. And today we have a very special guest. I was really, really honored to talk to this gentleman. His name is Charles Gaines, and Charles was the writer, the author of the book Pumping Iron, which came out in 1974. And he was also a part of the movie Pumping Iron. He did the narration for the movie, and he was there as a judge for the 1975 Mr. Olympia and Mr. Universe contest. And Charles also was the author of a book called Stay Hungry, which came out, I believe, in 1972. And it's a real success story because his book was made into a movie. And that movie came out in 1976, and it starred Arnold Schwarzenegger in his very first big Hollywood role, along with Jeff Bridges and Sally Field, directed by Bob Rafelson, who was a very prominent director in the 1970s. He directed Five Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson and a couple of other really big movies along at that time. So Charles wrote 2 books, and he had both of them made into movies, which if you look at that today is a real, real big undertaking, and it doesn't happen that often. So being a writer myself, it was an honor to talk to Charles. And I was actually a little nervous even talking to him because I bought his book, Pumping Iron, I think when I was about 13 years old in 1976. And if you've never read the book, you really try to get a hold of it because it's such an excellent book, so well written. Along with his book, Stay Hungry, is also very well written. It's sort of a quirky book, and they've got some offbeat characters. But when you get into the book, you really start to care about the fate of the characters and has a shocking ending. So that was a really excellent book as well. Charles was really a person I really wanted to talk to. I understand he doesn't really give too many interviews. Usually when they talk about the movie Pumping Iron, they usually talk to George Butler, who was the director of the movie and the photographer for the book. So you don't really see too many interviews with Charles Gaines. So it was a great pleasure to talk to him. And as you'll hear in the interview, Charles is a very articulate, thoughtful man, obviously a man of great intelligence. So again, it was really an honor to talk to Charles Gaines. As I mentioned, we are brought to you today by Redcon 1. And at Redcon 1, they believe in working hard at achieving your goals, whether you're killing it in the gym or you're running a 6-minute mile. Redcon 1 has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout, and it's going to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then after your workout, you can fuel your body with their revolutionary MRE. It is the only whole food complete meal replacement that has protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs. And their carbs come from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also contains 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. It's the best tasting complete meal you'll ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon 1, the highest state of readiness. And as a favor to the show, you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get a 15% discount off your order. We're also brought to you by Old School Labs, who makes uncompromisingly premium supplements. Old School Labs draws from the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is actually the brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. And it's the brand that I personally use to win and place high in the Masters Natural Universe in 2012 and many other competitions. And as a favor to the show, Old School Labs is giving you 12% off your purchase. So just go to oldschoollabs.com and use the code LEGEND12 at the checkout. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, we are recording this show on July 30th, and today is a very special day because it is the king of bodybuilding's birthday. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger's 70th birthday today. Arnold was born in 1947 on July 30th. So happy birthday to Arnold. He is still, in my mind, the king of the sport, the Muhammad Ali of bodybuilding. He is the same in our sport what Muhammad Ali was to boxing, of course. and wish Arnold a very happy birthday. He's still very busy, still doing movies, and he's still promoting the Arnold Classic Sports Festival with his partner, Jim Lorimer. They are now in every continent in the world. Arnold is always really, really busy, and we wish him a very happy birthday and a very healthy birthday. And as a tribute to Arnold, I have an article up right now on bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and it's about the life of Arnold Schwarzenegger, all in tribute to his birthday, which is today. So check that out at bodybuildinglegendshow.com. We just got that up this weekend. The big news this week was six-time Mr. Olympia Dorian Yates was featured on the Joe Rogan podcast. If you had a chance to listen to that, it was a really, really popular podcast. And I interviewed Dorian a couple of weeks ago, and I told him at the beginning of our interview that he's really doing a great job articulating the sport of bodybuilding to some of these mainstream broadcasters like Joe Rogan. He also did a podcast interview with Tim Ferriss, and he also did a series of interviews which were made into videos for London Real. Dorian's really doing a great job now, 20 years after he competed, but he's much more relaxed person now. He's very happy. So that's really, really good to see. He seems very healthy. And as I told him, he's really doing a great job of getting the bodybuilding knowledge out there to the average public. And as he told me, he said a lot of the general public just sees bodybuilders as a bunch of steroid freaks. And so Dorian is able to convey the hard work and the dedication that really goes into building a championship physique, whether you're Mr. Olympia or not. And Dorian epitomized that during his reign. He was the ultimate in dedication and hard work. He had a great career that lasted 6 Mr. Olympia titles. And I am just finishing up my part one of my video interview with Dorian. So we should have that up in the first week of August. So look for that. We might even also broadcast it as a podcast, so you can listen to it. If you're a member of the podcast community here over at Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, you'll be able to listen to it there too. So really looking forward to getting that interview up as soon as possible, because it was a great interview with Dorian Yates. And the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast is also brought to you by Six Pack Fitness. Six Pack Fitness creates premium, iconic meal management bags along with healthy, competitor-friendly hot sauces and accessories geared toward everyone from the serious athlete, bodybuilder, CrossFit, or fitness enthusiast. They provide stylish and innovative solutions for those who live active, healthy lifestyles. And these bags are essential for anyone who brings their food with them, whether they're going to work or to school, or if you're going on trips. They have spaces in the bag to put all your meals, and you also have spaces on the side of the bag for your protein drinks, for any other liquids, your supplements, your utensils, anything you need. Six-pack bags is a great product to have if you're serious about your diet and you need to stay on a certain diet every day. So check them out at sixpackbags.com, and you can use the promo code LEGENDS10 and receive 10% off your total purchase. If you're serious about your diet, you got to get these. And we're also brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. Do you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential? Then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They have a wide range of services that will ensure that you not only look and feel amazing, but you're comfortable knowing they're here for you every step of the way. They also have very competitive pricing along with their quality products, and they're just a few additional reasons to give them a try. So give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. They can work with anybody around the country, even if you're not in the Florida area, and you can use the promotion code LEGEND for a free consultation with them, and then you receive 20% off any packages you might purchase. You can call them at 813-906-6737. Or go to their website at opushealth.org. That's opeshealth.org. Or again, call them at 813-906-6737. All right. Thank you to all our sponsors for sponsoring another edition of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. And here is our interview, Charles Gaines, the author of the book Pumping Iron and the book Stay Hungry. Here you go.
Okay, joining us on the line from Nova Scotia is Charles Gaines, the author of both the book Pumping Iron and the book Stay Hungry, and was also involved, of course, in the film Pumping Iron. So, Charles, it's great to have you on the line.
Pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, it's really an honor to talk. I'm a proud owner of the original book, Pumping Iron. I think I bought it in 1976. And I also have your book, Stay Hungry. And as a struggling writer myself, I'm just like amazed at the writing in the book. I thought it was just fantastic. I just reread it this week. And it's so well written, Charles. It really was a fantastic book on bodybuilding.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. It was a great pleasure to write it.
So, Charles, I know you got involved in bodybuilding as a teenager, right, in Birmingham, Alabama?
That's right. I started out lifting weights in the 50s for football. Back in those days, weightlifting was not really an accepted practice for athletes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was supposed to be bad for athletes, and football players were discouraged from lifting weights, and all track athletes, of course, at that point, none of them used weights, and bodybuilding was practically non-existent. I mean, the Raiders were going, and there was, of course, Muscle Beach and all that out in California, but other than that, so far as national interest was concerned, there was pretty much zero, and what interest there was mostly negative. The concept of what bodybuilding was and what bodybuilders were was pretty negative at the time.
When did you first get involved with bodybuilding? I know your book, Pumping Iron, is dedicated to Joe Disco, and you talk about him in the book. Was he the inspiration for Joe Santo in Stay Hungry?
He was. And I started, as I say, I started lifting weight when I was about 16 at a downtown gym in Birmingham. And Disco was hanging around down there at the time, and he had been Mr. Alabama and won a variety of other competitions. And so because of him and because of his very magnetic personality. He reminded me a lot, actually, of Arnold. He attracted a lot of other people around the gym, and specifically a lot of bodybuilders. So that was my introduction to the culture.
What was the first contest you ever saw, Charles?
I'd have to really rack my memory for that. It was no doubt one of the smallish competitions in Alabama that Joe Disco used to go around to. I went with him to some of those, Mr. South Alabama, probably a Mr. Alabama contest at some point. But these were all local, not very well-produced shows. And as I say, bodybuilding was not really on the map at that point in the country nationwide. And so the quality of competition was not very high as well.
Right.
The first major bodybuilding show that I saw was much later, after I had gone to graduate school and lived in Ireland and done all kinds of things and then moved to New Hampshire. And my wife and I were living in Sunapee, New Hampshire, and I had just published Stay Hungry, and it had been a success. And I got a call from Sports Illustrated magazine asking me if I wanted to do an article about bodybuilding. And the editor at that time was a wonderful woman named Pat Ryan, and she said, nobody's ever written about bodybuilding for this magazine, and everybody here at the magazine has sort of a negative opinion of it. But we'd like for you to state in the opposite, a different case. And so if you'd like to go do a competition, they'll pay to send you down there and would love to buy the story. So I just put that kind of on the back burner because I was working on some other things at the time. And then I got a call from George Butler, who was at that point a young black and white photographer living in New Hampshire. And he had heard about me and read my book. And he called me up and said, I'm a photographer. I live up in northern New Hampshire, and I'd love to work with you sometime. If you ever get an offer where, you know, we can work together, I'd love to do it. So we had him down for dinner and got to know him and his wife, Victoria, and got to be friends. And I mentioned this bodybuilding offer that I'd had from Sports Illustrated to do a story about a competition. And George said, I'd love to do that. I used to be interested in bodybuilding when I lived in Jamaica, and I think it'd be great fun. So I got in touch with the WIDA organization, asked them about local competitions that were happening near New Hampshire, and found out that the Mr. East Coast competition was coming up in about a month. So George and I got in touch with Sports Illustrated. They okayed him as the photographer. We went down and covered the competition. And down there, we met Mike Katz. The competition was won by a fabulous black bodybuilder named Leon Brown, who, I don't know if you remember him or not, but he had one of the best backs ever in bodybuilding. But Mike Katz was down there, and we met Mike and got to talking to him. And he said, you know, you guys really ought to, if you want to do anything more on this, you ought to look up this young Austrian that's just moved to the U.S., and Weider has brought him over. And Katz had met him somewhere and said, you know, I think he's going to be the biggest thing in the history of bodybuilding. So George and I had really enjoyed covering the Mr. East Coast contest and the color of it and the, you know, the guys and the, all the backstage stuff and the humor. And at that point, Ed Jubenville, who was running the competition, was a master at what he called muscle control. He was a muscle control artist. He would get up on the stage and make all of his muscles jump around, and it was fabulous. You know, we took our wives down there, and they loved it. So anyway, long story short, I got another magazine assignment. George and I both did. Went down, covered, I think it was the Mr. Universe contest, and I don't even remember what year this was. It would have been the 70s. And I think it was Arnold's second competition in the U.S. We met him and Franco and Frank Zane and Sergio Nubre, a whole variety of guys. And we went back to our hotel that night, and after covering the competition, George and I did it. First of all, you had to be impressed by Arnold. I mean, a moron would have been impressed by Arnold. But more generally, we were impressed by, you know, how much color and life and vitality there was in this preoccupation of bodybuilding and how it had never really been brought to the fore. So we said, you know, why don't we do a book on it instead of just covering a bunch of individual competitions for magazines? I went to my agent at the time, who was one of the best in the world, and had represented me for Stay Hungry. And he said, no, that ain't my cup of tea. No, thanks. So then I went to Sandy Richardson, who was the head of Doubleday. Doubleday had published Stay Hungry, and he was the chief there and also a good friend. And I said, Sandy, I want to do this book, and I'm really excited about it, on bodybuilding. And he said, man, look, Stay Hungry was a great success for us. We really believe in you. We want to keep you, but that's, you know, nobody but perverts and weird people are interested in bodybuilding. And he said, right. That book's not going to sell two copies. He said, I hate to tell you, but I can't do it. So we said, all right. So we started going out to California, hanging out with out of Gold's Gym anyway, and taking notes and so forth, because I knew we'd find a market for it. And we got a lot of research under our belt. And I was in Key West visiting a novelist friend of mine named Tom McGuane, and there was a young agent there visiting McGuane from New York, a guy named Bob Dottila. And I was telling them this story about how I'd had such a hard time getting any interest in this book from publishing. And this young agent, cocky young guy from Queens, said, I'll sell it, man. I think it's a great idea. I'll sell it for you. He went back to New York, and 2 weeks later we got a call. He said, I've got an appointment with Dan Green, who was the head of Simon & Schuster at that point. And George and I went in to meet Dan Green and had a meeting with him and laid the whole thing out and said, look, we got to have, back in those days, a pretty good bit amount of pretty good piece of change, because we got to travel around a lot to do this, so we need a pretty good advance. And he said, how much do you need? And we named a figure. It was up in the six figures. And he said, you got it. Go to it, boy. So that was that was really the origin of the whole thing. And then, of course, the movie Pumping Iron followed the book.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I think you met Arnold in 72, right, at the Mr. America? And I read that you and George...
That would have been at 72, and that would have been just after Stay Hungry was published.
Right.
I'm bad on dates, but when you get as old as I am, you know, the 70s is a long way back there.
Right.
Yeah, I can't remember, but it was right in there somewhere in the early 70s, yeah.
I heard that you and George went to breakfast with Arnold the next day, and I think George wrote in his book that he wrote about Arnold, he said that Arnold sort of laid out his master plan for his life, how he was going to conquer bodybuilding and then go into the movies and then eventually go into politics. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. It was sort of breathtaking, in fact. You know, I mean, we had, for the purposes of the story, to add some sort of journalistic color, I guess you'd call it, we put Arnold and a bunch of the other guys who came from California up at one of the storied literary hotels in New York called the Algonquin.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not at all where that's the home of the famous Round Table with Dorothy Parker and that whole group of great journalists, great New York journalists of the 1940s and 50s. And it, you know, it's one of the toniest, most literary hotels in New York, and not at all where they would have stayed. And the contrast, which is what we were hoping for, And Arnold was the only one really who really got it. You know, I mean, he really got the contrast. And so he said, why don't we have breakfast here tomorrow morning? And we did. George and I met him at the Algonquin. We had breakfast. And he did do exactly that. He laid out this master plan for his life where he planned to prove himself the best bodybuilder who ever lived, win the Mr. Olympia contest, whatever it was, seven times or eight or whatever, and go on to, I remember this phrase exactly, marry an American princess, make a ton of money, go into the movie business, capture that. And then I don't remember his saying that he had aspirations for a political life, but George does, and George has a better memory than I do, so no doubt he was right about that. But it was, as I say, it was breathtaking to hear this guy just off the boat from Austria, you know, with very bad English, wearing, he didn't know how to dress at that point, he didn't know how to do anything, you know, I mean, lycra shorts, and, I mean, he just was a bumpkin, you know, I mean, an Austrian bumpkin laid out in New York. And to hear him lay out step by step the way that he planned to conquer the world was, you know, you had to figure, well, he, you know, he's either got the what it takes to do it or he's certifiably insane. And there wasn't any question in mine and George's mind. And this is something that is important about all this because, you know, at that point, Arnold was known by nobody except other bodybuilders and the bodybuilding industry. I mean, he hadn't done, I think maybe he'd made that horrible little movie called Hercules in New York or something. I don't know whether that had been released or not. But I mean, he had no following. Nobody knew who he was. And George and I, the minute we met the guy, knew that he was going to be a star. You know, that, that there was no way to keep this guy from doing whatever he wanted to do. I mean, I've had a very fortunate life. I've traveled all over the world, and I've known all kinds of movie stars and politicians, and I've met lots and lots of charismatic people in my life, but nobody who had the overpowering degree of charisma that Arnold had from the get-go.
That's amazing.
You know, with absolutely no sophistication. And then, of course, when it got all that got polished over a period of time, it was even more potent.
Yeah, was it true that you were the one that mentioned to Arnold that bodybuilding is like building your body like a work of art? And when you said that to him, it sort of clicked, and then he started using that phrase?
Yeah, that is true. We were coming back from Woodland Hills or wherever I think it's called Woodland Hills, where the Weider organization was.
Yeah.
Driving back to Santa Monica from there, and Arnold was in the back seat, and I think George was driving, and I was sitting in the passenger seat. And I had had this metaphor that kept occurring to me while I was out there that, you know, I mean, it's a pretty obvious metaphor, that the bodybuilders are like sculptors of their bodies and that they look at their body in the mirror and say, you know, that forearm needs another quarter of an inch or that calf needs another 2 inches. And then by diet and exercise, they put it on the same way a sculptor would add for symmetry or proportion or take away. And so I mentioned, you know, I said, what do you think of this? What do you think of this idea? And there was this long pause, and he said, yeah, it's true. And then we discussed it all the way back in the car, George and Arlen and I, how rich that metaphor was and how many different levels it applied to the sport. And, you know, within 2 weeks, Arnold was talking about how he always thought of himself as a Michelangelo of his body. But, you know, I mean, one of the many remarkable things about Arnold was how he sopped up everything. You know, I mean, he learned to dress from George Butler. He learned manners by manners, I don't mean table manners, but how to act in different societies from all kinds of people. We would take him to Elaine's in New York, which was at that point the literary hangout for all of New York, Woody Allen, George Plimpton, yeah, everybody, James Baldwin, Norman Mailer, everybody who wrote back in those periods hung out at Elaine's, and a ton of movie stars. We'd take Arnold in there, and he would just sit and watch, and he would soak up behavior and ideas and metaphors and so forth. I've never seen a more absorbent mind Arnold's. And, of course, when he came here, he wanted to learn, and he had the capacity to do it. I mean, one of the many undervalued aspects of Arnold is he's got a first-rate mind. I mean, you know, not just an okay adequate mental setup, but a really first-rate mind. And he used that as one of the many tools of his, to build his career. And he used it in, as I say, a very interesting way. I mean, he would soak up things from people and then apply them in ways that he could actualize. So, you know, that listening in the back of the car, that metaphor thing, and then adopting it, making it his own, is just one tiny example of hundreds of things that I've seen him do that are similar.
What also impressed me about Arnold in those early days was not only his charisma, which was evident. I think anybody can testify to that of meeting him. I remember I met him in 1977, and I was nervous to meet him because I could just feel the charisma. But
yeah,
also his confidence. I remember him appearing on The Tonight Show in the late 70s with Johnny Carson, who at the time was a legend, and there was only three stations on back then, and to appear on The Tonight Show was really a big deal. And he was on there so confident and so relaxed, hanging out with all these movie stars and talking to Johnny like he knew him for years. And I was just amazed, this, you know, I think at the time 30-year-old bodybuilder who nobody knew was able to go on one of the biggest talk shows in the world and just be so relaxed and so confident.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, his confidence was overpowering. And even earlier than that, in 1970, well, right after the book came out, whatever year that was, 75, I think, or something, Arnold and George and I went on the Today Show with Barbara Walters, which at that point was, you know, that was the biggest talk show, daytime talk show in the country, and she was the premier hostess. And I was impressed by that and a little bit nervous about going on the Today Show. Arnold was just like, it was nothing. And he went on the show, I'll never forget, he went on the show, and she looked at him and said, "You don't really look all that big." And he said, "Feel this." And did a flex his bicep, stuck it over there, and she felt it and said, "Oh, yeah, well, I could see." He had it on a jacket, and it was hard to tell, you know. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, he just was playful with her and loose, and he's been that way all of his life, I think. You know, he's never had a doubtful moment in his life.
right.
Most of us, no matter how talented or smart or whatever you are, all of us are plagued with a certain amount of self-doubt and a certain amount of self-consciousness. But Arnold just was seen to have been born without it.
Well, it was really amazing how you and George came along at a time, and then you really promoted the sport of bodybuilding. And, reading your book again this week, Pumping Iron, I was just amazed at how you really brought it out to the everyman, and you really made it understandable, and you made it exciting. Like, there was one part where you were talking about when you were training at that Magic City Health Club in Birmingham, and you would walk out to go to Joy Young's Chinese restaurant.
Yeah,
after,
right.
And you just totally captured what it felt like to go to the gym and have a great workout and feel on top of the world and walk out of there. And it was just really amazing how you put all that together.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun to write that book because we knew we were in new terrain.
Mm-hmm.
We were writing about something that nobody had ever, writing and photographing about something that nobody had covered seriously. I mean, there had been books about bodybuilding, but to cover for a general market. And as you say, what I tried to do in that book was to make all the components of bodybuilding, the exercises themselves, the dieting, the posing, come alive for people so that they could see how incredibly demanding the sport is and also how incredibly beautiful it is when it's done at the top levels.
Yeah, you really did do that. And the book, with the way it was set up, was really exciting also because you were covering the 1972 Mr. Universe in Baghdad with Mike Katz and Ed Corney, and then you were also covering the 1973 Mr. Olympia in New York, and it was leading up to that. So as you were talking about nutrition maybe or training and how the bodybuilders build their body, and there was one chapter where it was all about the history of bodybuilding, but then it was all leading up to that big showdown in New York where Arnold was going to win, and then also that was a great coverage of the 1972 Mr. Universe because you showed how big bodybuilding was in Baghdad, how it was like one of the biggest sports in that country.
I know, exactly. It blew us away how hugely popular it was all over the Middle East. I mean, we went not only to Iraq, we were in Iran for a while and Lebanon, and all over the Middle East. It was enormous. It was like NASCAR or something.
So what was it like seeing Arnold, you know, as a bodybuilding fan for 40 years now? I mean, and I'm so jealous that you got to see him at his best in like 73, 74, 75. And I know, I think you were a judge, right, at the Mr. Olympia a couple of years in 74 and 75?
I was an IFBB judge for a few years, yeah.
So what was it like to see him on stage at his prime doing his thing?
Well, I mean, it was incredible. It defined the sport and the art. I mean, I think the subtitle of the book, Pumping Iron, is The Sport and the Art of Bodybuilding.
Right.
I hold that it's both, you know, that it's both a sport and an art. And Arnold was a master of both. And, you know, I mean, there have been guys since Arnold who were bigger, mm-hmm. who were more ripped and so forth. I haven't followed bodybuilding all that close since those days. So, you know, I've been to a couple of competitions at Arnold's invitation, and I've followed a little bit in the magazines and stuff, but I really don't know that much about it. But I do know that there have been guys who, in just terms of sheer size and muscularity, could be said to have been better than Arnold, if that's the gauge that you use. Whether or not there's ever been anybody who put all the components together as well as he did, I don't know. I mean, I personally kind of doubt it. But the predominant thing that you were conscious of watching Arnold, both as a judge and at that point a very good friend when he was performing on stage, was his absolute mastery of the environment. And by that I mean it was a mental mastery. And, you know, the mm-hmm. story's a legend about how he was able to psych people out. There's a little bit of that in the movie Pumping Iron when he plays around with Lou Ferrigno.
Mm-hmm.
And he also played around a lot with Sergio Oliva and different guys who he was competing with. And he was a master at that, at psyching people out and making them think, you know, that they were not as good as they actually were and come not as prepared as they should have and that sort of thing. But it was more just a kind of joyful mastery of the entire milieu, of the entire environment. I mean, I'm put in mind of, I once watched Valencia, the great Spanish matador, fight a bull in Madrid. And it was very similar to watching Arnold. I know this is a weird, weird comparison, but indulge me. It was very similar to watching Arnold compete, because Valencia would come into the ring and he owned it. And you knew from the minute he walked in the ring that he owned it. And
yeah.
What was going to happen with the bull was not even in question. It was a question of watching the beauty of the ritual that led up to what happened to the bull and being a part of that mastery that Valencia was able to exert in the ring. So watching Arnold was very similar to that, because there was never really any question in any of the competitions that I judged that he was going to win them. But it was the beauty of watching him do it and watching the absolute mastery over the stage, himself, the other competitors, the sport itself.
Yeah, and you also capture how important the posing is. And I think I even quoted from your book, Pumping Iron, before, where you talk about when it's done right, it's the most beautiful thing to see. And when it's done wrong, of course, it's embarrassing.
Oh, exactly. It's just, yeah, it's embarrassing. Right. No, that's right. And Arnold was a very, very good poser. And as you know, he took ballet lessons to help his posing. He wasn't maybe a great poser in the same league with Ed Corney, Frank Zane,
mm-hmm.
you know, a few others at that time. But he was, if he wasn't an A+, he was an A-. And he was certainly better than 98% of the rest of the people on the stage. And that, combined with all the rest of the things that he brought to the sport, just made his performances really kind of incandescent.
And I think that's something we might have lost over the years in bodybuilding, because I was around during the late 70s, early 80s, and I can attest to how the crowds were. I remember going to the late 70s Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio, from 77 to 79, and the crowds were just insane. There was just a magic in the air from those competitions that I think we've lost today. And some of it may have to do with the posing. Some of it may have to do with the internet, I guess. Maybe, you know, people are too familiar with the bodybuilders were before they were like movie stars. But I think you really captured how magical it was during those times in both, you know, your book and your movie.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it may have to do with the fact that at that point, I think symmetry and proportion and beauty of line were more important than they may be now. And so the posing, you know, Frank Zane's posing, for example, or Ed Corney's, which is like watching mobile art. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it went back to the old days. I forget the name of that guy, back in the old days. He's in the book Pumping Iron, who was supposed to have been such a beautiful poser. But that goes back to the, Steve Reeves was also a great poser. Goes back to the days when they saw themselves as living art, and they wanted the poses to reflect that. It seems to me now that the little bit that I know about it, that modern posing is more kind of a statement of raw power and raw size and massiveness and so forth, less than it is about eloquence of line and so forth.
There's a passage from the book, if I could read it real quick, where you were talking about Ed Corney at the 1972 Mr. Universe. And he said he doesn't knock people over with his size the way Katz does, not even flexing really, so much as arranging the muscle groups in smooth serpentine shifts that surprise and gratify as you watch. It is a poetic kind of posing that no one does it as well as he. I thought that was perfect the way you put that.
That's exactly what he did. And, you know, you were conscious when you were watching Corney, you're watching something that was really rare. There's no way that anybody that you could, like we took, for example, we took Kurt Vonnegut, who was a great friend of mine, a writer. I don't know, maybe. I don't know if you know who he is, but anyway, major American writer. And his wife, Jill Crimmins, who was a photographer. And these were very hoity toity New York people, very cerebral, you know, not at all sports minded, didn't have a clue what bodybuilding was. And if they did, would sort of chuckle when they heard the phrase. Mm-hmm. We took them to a competition down at the Brooklyn Academy of Music where Ed Corney was posing. And, you know, they watched all this stuff, and they were spellbound with it. Mm. It didn't matter what milieu you came from, what background you came from. You couldn't watch Corney without being knocked out by it, knowing you were looking at some form of art. Strange, yes, but beautiful.
Absolutely. Talking about your book, Stay Hungry, I didn't realize until I read Randy Roach's book that that book was a finalist in the, for a National Book Award in 1972.
Yeah, it was. It was one of the last five books voted on for the National Book Award of that year.
How did that become a movie? I know director Bob Rafelson, he liked the book, right?
He did, and it was very unlikely that, you know, that that book, which is a peculiar book, an eccentric book, that it would become a movie. And it only did so out of a sort of freaky combination of accidents. Somebody gave Bob the book, gave Bob Rafelson the book as a present, and he read it, and he just thought, this is me for some reason, you know, this is, I've got to put this on the screen. So he called me out of the blue. He found me in New Hampshire, called me, and I knew his movies. I mean, I loved his movies. He directed Five Easy Pieces, which is one of my favorite American movies of all time. King of Marvin Gardens, which is, you know, another one of my favorites. He produced Easy Rider, you know, I mean, great director. And he called and said, you know, I love this book, but he said, you may not want to work with me because your book is a tragedy, and what I want to make is a comedy.
Hmm.
And I said, well, I don't know how that would work. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, let me buy you a ticket out here to L.A., fly out here, give me like 4 days, and let's just sit around and chew the fat about it. And you go home, you don't want to do it, fine, we'll call the whole thing off. And if you do, we'll put it together. So I went out, and, you know, Bob was one of the most brilliant men ever as a director, and an extremely literate director as well. And we had great conversations, and he told me what his concept was of how to redo the book and to make it into a comedy. And I said, you know, sure. All right, let's try it. So we co-wrote the script. I moved out there and lived in his house and for 4 months. And we co-wrote the script and then took it to Universal. Was it Universal? I think it was Universal, the studio that did it. And Mike Medavoy was the producer.
Okay.
Became the head of another big studio, I forget which one. But anyway, he loved the script, and so we got the green light and then cast it and made it.
So you wrote your first screenplay then also?
That's right, and had the great good fortune to write it with a pro, write it with somebody who knew what he was doing. He said, you go home and write a script. And I said, I don't know how to write a script. He said, that's fine, write it anyway, and read some scripts if you want to, write it anyway, and then bring it out here and we'll rework it. And that's exactly what I did. I wrote made the mistake that all beginning screenwriters make and made it like 300 pages when it's got to be a maximum of 120, and brought it out, and we worked on it for 4 months, and he brought at least as much to it as I did. He was kind enough to give me first credit on the script, but he did at least as much work on it as I did. And it won some awards. It won a Golden Globe Award for Best Script of that year, and Arnold won the Golden Globe Award for Best Performance by a Newcomer.
Right, I remember that. Filling that role of Joe Santo in the movie, who was the bodybuilder in the movie, were you helpful in getting Arnold that role? Because there really were not too many bodybuilders in Hollywood at the time, right?
Yeah, and that's a long story. I'll give you the very short version. I had already done the stories, the magazine stories about Arnold, and met him. And
okay.
George and I were already anticipating doing a book on bodybuilding. And I said to Bob Rafelson, you know, there's really only one guy who can play this role, and he lives here. Can I get him out to meet you? He said, sure, bring him out. He said, who is he? And I told him a little bit about Arnold. We got him out to his house. He lived just off of Mulholland Drive up in Hollywood Hills, and brought Arnold up there. And, you know, he was charming as always. And Bob's wife, Toby Rafelson, who was the art director for the movie and still one of our dearest friends, loved Arnold, and he loved her. And so he went home, and I said, so, right, we got Santo cast. And he said, you kidding me? He said, hey, that's not going to work. I said, why not? He said, well, you know, the guy's muscle-bound. He can't speak English. No doubt he can't act. You know, there's just too many problems with him. What we need to do is find an actor who is built well enough so that we can cast him. And I said, look, you're not going to do it. You're not going to find – promise you this is the truth. I said, it's not going to happen. You're going to wind up casting Arnold. Why waste the time? Just do it. And he said, no, believe me, he's not the guy. So we wasted like a month or two, and we must have rehearsed 400 actors who were also bodybuilders, you know, amateur bodybuilders. Some of them were, you know, pretty big, looked pretty good, but nobody who had the charisma of Arnold, who had anywhere like the, you know, when you looked at Arnold in those days, you were looking at, like, because it was pre-Lee Haney and all, you know, all the kind of monster muscle stuff. And when normal people looked at him, it just took your breath away, you know, because he was like a different animal than everybody else. So finally, I'm not making it short enough, but finally Rafelson came to me one night and he said, you know what? we got to cast this guy. I mean, there's no other way we can do it. We're going to have to get him a voice cleaner, they called it at that point, a voice coach that you work with to get rid of some of the accent. And we're going to have to get him acting lessons and all the rest, but he's our boy. So we called him back over to his house, and Arnold, you know, he's got that big gap between his teeth, his two front teeth. I'll never forget. He gave Bob this huge grin. He said, Bob, it's about time you came around.
And he was really very good in that movie. I think that was, to this day, one of his best acting performances.
He was great. He was great. And for it to be his first role, you know, he was working with two very finished and wonderful actors, with Sally Field and Jeff Bridges. And they both loved him. And they were like, you know, having your personal coaches on the set every day. And Jeff particularly helped Arnold a huge amount. But he did a great job, I thought. And he did win a Golden Globe Award for it.
Were you out there, Charles, when they were filming that? Were you out there?
Oh, yeah, I was there every day. I was. The scriptwriter is usually on the set because movie scripts are a very fluid medium, and actors or the director are always calling for a change. You know, an actor will say, you know what, I really can't say this line. And then Bob Rufus will say, Charles, we take an hour, go back and rewrite this. So, you know, it's important to have the writer on the set every day, and I was on there every day and learned a lot. You know, I mean, I went on to write other scripts in Hollywood until I got sick of working with the people out there for about five more years or six or seven more years, and I learned a tremendous amount by working with Bob on the set.
Now, that book, Pumping Iron, Stay Hungry, I know that sometimes creative writers, when you're writing a fiction story, you'll use a lot that took place in your life. So how much of that book had some personal experiences in there also?
Some. I grew up in the same sort of privileged circumstances that Craig Blake grew up in. And my family home was very similar to the home that he lives in. And I never worked in the real estate business, but I had a group of people that I hung out with that were similar to the ones that he hangs out with. And I had a country club that I grew up going to as a kid, very similar to the one that's in the book. That's about it. And as you say, you know, I mean, all novels use parts of the novelist. I mean, you can't help but do that. And, you know, some have more of the novelist invested in a character than others, but all good novelists invest themselves in their characters in one way or another. And there's a lot of Craig Blake in me, but I like to think not quite all, because, you know, he had some serious failings as well. I mean, at the end of the book, I mean, that was one of the things that Bob Rafelson wanted to change and did, but in the book, you know, he turns out to have this fatal inability to commit, which in the context of the book cost the life of one character and has other tragic consequences as well.
How did you feel about the movie Stay Hungry? Did you like it, how it came out?
To be honest with you, you know, I thought it had its moments, and I thought that, you know, there were some good performances in it and so forth, but I wasn't crazy about it, no.
Now, I know George decided to do the movie Pumping Iron right around that time, right? Right around early spring of 1975?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he came down to the set where we were working in Alabama, and he brought the man who turned out to be the primary producer of Pumping Iron, named Jerome Gary, with him. And George had met Jerome Gary at Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival, and he had told Jerome that he wanted to make this movie, Pumping Iron, and that he was trying to raise money for it. And Jerome, who at that point was a sort of fledgling producer, said, well, I think I can help you out with that. I'll help you raise the money. So George came down with Jerome and pitched the idea of the movie to me, the movie of Pumping Iron. And I said, yeah, I think it's a great idea, and I'll sign on to it. And they wanted me to write the film and to narrate it, which I wound up doing. And that was Jerome's first introduction to Arnold and the rest of the, you know, the whole culture of bodybuilding and to the rest of the bodybuilders. So that was sort of the, and that's where we got serious about going out and trying to raise the money for it.
So how was that whole experience being out in California that summer and while all the guys were training for the Mr. Olympia and the Mr. Universe and filming that?
Oh, it was great. You know, I mean, Gold's Gym at that point was just a great place to be. It was just seething with energy and optimism and fun. I mean, I've never been in a more fun place. Everybody had such a great time, you know, and great time working out. And then there were so many characters around at that point, you know, Waller and Roger Callard was one.
Yeah.
And Franco, of course, who's always good. And Arnold, who was the kind of king clown. And we'd, you know, we'd go from there to these huge lunches and then go hang out on the beach. And, you know, it was just a ball. It was great. It was almost like we shouldn't be being paid to do this.
Right. I think that's what really captured everybody's attention with Pumping Iron. I think that's why people still love it today, 40 years later, is because of all the camaraderie and the fun that was involved in the movie. And I think people can really see that. I know they came out with a movie called Generation Iron a couple of years ago, and they were trying to cover modern-day bodybuilding. And that was one of the big differences I noticed between Pumping Iron and Generation Iron, was Pumping Iron was so much fun, and it was so motivating. And when you saw it, you wanted to go out and work out. You really wanted to get involved in this bodybuilding. But Generation Iron was just, it was too serious, and I don't think a young person watching that movie would want to get involved in bodybuilding.
Yeah, and, you know, that was just pure luck. I mean, George and I don't take any credit for having caused that sense of fun in the movie. It just happened to be that at that point at Muscle Beach and in Gold's Gym and among that particular group of bodybuilding stars, there was a magic, you know, and you can't invent that. I mean, you either hit it or you don't. And we just happened to hit it at a golden age when that was the defining mood and the defining attitude, one of fun and joyousness.
I remember when
they were just lucky enough to fall into the middle of it.
When they showed Raw Iron, which was some of the extra footage from Pumping Iron, and I remember there was one part where you were interviewing Arnold and you were trying to get into what motivates him, and you were asking him, does anything scare him? And he was saying, yes. And then you called him out on it and you said, I think you're bullshitting me.
I don't actually remember that. But and in fact, I don't think I've ever seen the footage called Raw Iron.
Oh, really?
That was,
okay.
No, I don't think so. I'd love to. I mean, if I ever get a chance to find it somewhere, I will. But, you know, that was footage that Arnold bought and put out on his own, and that was long after I had gone on to other things and wasn't that much involved with bodybuilding anymore. But Arnold was, you know, Arnold could bullshit you and mm-hmm. would in a heartbeat. And in fact, he loved to do that with people. We got, and by we, I mean Arnold and I particularly, got to be really close, very close friends. And he visited me in New Hampshire. I took him fishing in Yellowstone and taught him how to fly fish. And, you know, mm-hmm. we did a documentary for ABC on grizzly bears together. We did a lot of non-bodybuilding related things. We got to be very good friends. And I like to think that, you know, I got to know him well enough so that I knew when he was bullshitting and when he wasn't. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that I did call him out on that. But I don't remember that particular incident.
Yeah, that had to be a fascinating part of Arnold's life to be involved with him and to know him, because I've been a fan of Arnold for all my life. But I think that period in the late 70s, right after Pumping Iron came out, when he was promoting himself, before he made ever any one of his bigger movies, I think that had to be a great time to know him, because he seemed like he was very motivated. He knew what he wanted to do with his life, and he had that master plan, so to speak, and that had to be a great period to know him in his life.
It was, and, you know, the thing that made it even more gratifying was that Arnold at that point still had a large degree of childlikeness about him. And mm-hmm. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean it in a good way. I mean, he still had a capacity for just raw joy, for just being thrilled with things and for being surprised. And there was a certain wonderful kind of humility about Arnold at that point that he lost after a while, as people tend to do. But, I mean, I think he was at his very best in those years, and it was a great pleasure to know him. And, you know, I still remember him as one of the dearest friends in my life at that point. I mean, we kind of grew apart later on, and there were some issues that aren't worth going into. Like life does a lot of times, it gets in the way, and it pushes people apart, and Arnold and I are no longer close. And I think Arnold's a very different person now than he was in the 70s. But at that point, he was one of the most charming, wonderful, joyous people on the planet.
Yeah, I loved when he ever did interviews back then. He was so candid and open and honest, and it was just a great time in his life. I love looking at interviews from when he was around back then. Charles, Sean Perrine dubbed you and George the Lewis and Sullivan of bodybuilding, and I think that was really accurate because you guys came along at just the right time, and you promoted the sport of bodybuilding in a way that I thought was very classy, and it really opened up the sport to the general public, and it was just really an amazing series of coincidences that everything came together, and you guys did that fantastic book, and then you did the movie, and that Stay Hungry coincided with that also. So it was really great that you were there in history, and I think you really changed the sport for the better.
Well, as I said, it was, one of these fortunate things. I've been blessed in my life by having two things that fell in my lap. One was bodybuilding, another was paintball, which I was instrumental in starting. And, you know, they were both just fortune. Life just happens to you in such a way that you can be involved in something that turns out to be way bigger than yourself and to be instrumental in bringing that to other people. And, as I say, I feel very blessed to have had bodybuilding happen to me at the time that it did, and to have been able to participate in broadening its appeal mm-hmm. in America and all around the world.
Yeah, I think you did an amazing job. I don't think anybody could have did it better.
Well, you're very kind to say so. We had a great time doing it, and I think, you know, all good art has an element of naturalness and joy to it, mm-hmm. of exuberance. And I think what defines both the book and the movie, Pumping Iron, is, and you put your finger on it very presciently a few minutes ago, is that sense of exuberance. That's what defined both the book and the movie, I think.
Well, it was a magical time. And like I said, I really am grateful for the work that you and George Butler did in covering the sport in both the book and the movie. And I think the sport, like I said, is better for it, and we really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us, Charles, and for telling us all those great stories. Like I said, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I've read your book since, I think, when I was 13 years old, so it's been really an honor to talk to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. You're a great interviewer, and the questions are very well phrased as well as well thought out. And if I ever get down to Tampa, I'll come shake your hand in your gym.
Oh, it'd be great to meet you.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Charles. Thanks for your time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, I want to thank Charles Gaines for joining us on the show. As I said, it was really an honor for me to talk to him. Next week on the show, we are going to be joined by bodybuilder Mike Katz, who was a big part of the movie Pumping Iron. And Mike, of course, was featured in the book and the movie Pumping Iron. I did an interview with Mike before for the Bodybuilding Legends interviews that's on our video section of the website. So I was really happy that Mike was able to talk to us again specifically about the movie Pumping Iron. So that'll be next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Redcon One, Old School Labs, Florida Alternative Medicine, and Six Pack Bags for sponsoring the show. And we will see you guys next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.